Welcome to the You Love and You Learn podcast, the place to learn about all things love, relationships, relationship anxiety, and to deconstruct the one-size-fits-all narrative of what it means to be in a happy relationship. I'm your host, Sarah Yudkin, a relationship anxiety coach who's on a mission to discuss the nuances of love and relationships that I wish someone would have shared with me years ago. My goal with each episode is for you to leave with an expanded definition of love and relationships and with practices to carry with you in your life and relationships on a day-to-day basis. I'm so grateful to have you here. Welcome back to another episode. So happy to be here with you as always, and I'm excited for today's conversation. I sat down with Anna Aslanian, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist and the founder of My Therapy Corner. She has over 15 years of expertise and specializes in trauma-informed and attachment-focused therapy, employing modalities such as EMDR and Gottman method to address root issues. And the Gottman method and the Gottman approaches is what we sat down and talked about today. And I'm a huge fan of the Gottman Institute and the Gottmans and all of their relationship wisdom. For those who are not familiar, John and Julie Gottman have been studying relationships for over 40 years, and they have a ton of information based on statistics and research that they've seen. And I really love a lot of their approaches. And so I'm really excited that Anna got to sit down with us and talk through that today as a Gottman Method specialized therapist. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. Hi, Anna. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited because as I was learning more about you and your work, I saw on your website, and I just have some notes here. I want to read all of the different modalities that you pull from. And it was just so cool to see the breadth of wisdom that you're going to bring into this conversation. But you are an EMDR psychotherapist, attachment-focused EMDR therapist. You've worked with acceptance and commitment therapy, polyvagal framework, and are trauma-informed in addition to being a certified Gottman couples therapist, which is what we're going to dive into more today. But I love how many different modalities you pull from. And I'm just curious, how does that impact the work that you do with individuals or couples when you're pulling from so many different modalities?
I love that question. And I think if you ask different therapists, there is this thing amongst therapists and just mental health practitioners that I personally don't like as much, which is that whatever modality they are trained in, they think that's the solution to all the problems. And I think there are so many different amazing modalities out there. And, you know, first of all, research shows that the best thing you can do for your clients is just have a really good relationship with them where they can feel completely safe in your presence. And that is a really great indicator in itself. But also, each person is still so different that I think that there isn't really one modality that can work on everybody, you know, and I'm really passionate about all the modalities that I like. So I do have my favorites as well. I think it's only natural for us to like what we like. But I've had clients that when they come in, even though I really love this modality and I think this really makes sense for them and it would guide them through this process and there would be so much progress, they're not there yet. Maybe they're not ready to feel what's in their body, for example, or jump into trauma work, and they're maybe highly logical and that's easier access for them. So then there is modalities that can really focus on that first to get them ready for this, right? So I like the reason I got certified and trained in different modalities and I'm continuously learning. I'm in actually one right now, halfway through for EFT, emotionally focused therapy as well, which really explores attachment in more detail, is because I want to meet the clients where they're at. And once I get to know you and I understand how you process things and how can I get in, what is going to be the language, so to say, that's going to really get to you and make the most progress, that's the modality I will use. And sometimes I'll combine different ones to really tailor it to the client instead of trying to have them fit into what I think is the best. Because I mean, they are, again, all of them are so great in many different ways. It's just what's going to be best for the client.
Yeah, I love that because I know I have, and then other clients have asked me before too, of just, well, what is the best way? Or like, should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? And I feel like anytime you're putting that pressure on yourself of this is the right way or that is the wrong way, then you're adding a lot more expectation to the process of your own growth and self-discovery. And then it doesn't become a curious exploration, it becomes almost like you're trying to get the A on the test and heal properly. So I'm really glad that you brought that piece in as the permission slip for people to keep exploring and keep finding ways or modalities that resonate with them versus just feeling like you have to go a certain direction.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, today we are going to zoom in on one specific modality, the Gottman method. And I've learned so much from the Gottman Institute. I feel like they're obviously such a powerhouse and share so much wisdom with the masses through books and through their findings on social media and articles and all of the places. But I'm really excited to get a peek behind the curtain at what it looks like to go through Gottman method couples counseling or individual therapy. So if a couple is coming to you, let's just, because a lot of listeners are in a relationship already, if you are working with a couple and you're starting to take them through the Gottman method, what are some of the initial things you're looking at? Where do you even start with that process?
So the Gottman method is amazing in that it's so research-based, and they've done this for such a long time in terms of what makes relationship work, what doesn't, and not in the way of I'm seeing my couple and I'm like, you're doomed, you're going to make it, you may be, you not so much. It's not like that. It's more about, we know what works, and there are specific research-based interventions and tools I can give you and guide you through. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to do the work, you can learn that. And it takes time, of course, just like learning anything, to do something different so it can work this time. The Gottmans also have a very detailed assessment. And I love that because it takes time to really get to know someone, right? And there are specific things we need to know to get the bigger picture, the whole picture, before we go into treatment. The main complaint I've had from couples who come in and who've tried couples therapy with some practitioners who maybe didn't really specialize in couples as much was that they'll say, we went to couples therapy for years or so many months, and we just kind of complained and fought, and then came home and it was even worse and nothing really changed. It was, yeah, maybe we felt heard, but there wasn't anything that we could do differently. So with the Gottman, we're not just the witness to your problems. I don't just listen to what's going on. I jump in a lot and give you a lot of tools of what to do, what not to do. So it's very interactive in that sense and collaborative as well. But the first few sessions are just assessment where I'm asking very detailed and in-depth questions to get to know your relationship, your timeline from the moment you met up until now, everything that's happened, good or bad, transitions, adjustments of life. I also meet with a couple individually with each partner just one time. And that's the only time I will see couples individually when I'm seeing them as a couple. But that's also for me to understand what else is happening with you individually. What else do you bring into your relationship? Because we all have histories. We all have different ways of processing information. We have our sensitivities and things that might trigger us. Also, it's a really good opportunity for each person to feel comfortable with me and know that I understand you. So when we meet in couples, if something comes up, I know what might be your block or what might be happening for you, so I can help you through it. You know, that said, most couples therapists do have a no secrets policy, which means that I don't keep secrets. If you come in our individual sessions and tell me something, you should be also prepared to bring it up in our joint session. That way it's fair to everyone and the relationship is respected.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then from there, is there a flow of the certain principles of the Gottman method that you take people from in an order, or is it unique to every pairing or every relationship that you're seeing?
First, when we do the assessment, I go over what's called the sound relationship house. Sound relationship house, if you Google it, it will come up. It literally is a house. And Gottmans have done amazing research and sort of summarized their theory in that little house. And it's very symbolic in the form of a house, right? Because you're building something together. There is union. And each level is important in their own way. And we go over where the couple falls in each level of that house. So that could be their friendship levels, right? Or how they manage conflict, or if, you know, their values and more of those parts match, commitment, trust. We go over all of that. And then collaboratively, we'll decide where we're going to start depending on each couple. You know, sometimes they come in and they're in the crisis. You know, most couples actually come in when there are problems. We do get sometimes couples coming in for premarital, for example. We're doing great. We just want to make sure we have the skills now for the future. That's really awesome when couples do that. But a lot of them come in when there's already a problem and they might be in a crisis state where they really want to fix something. So most of the time they will start with some kind of conflict management skills. But I've also had couples work on their friendship, work on their romance and other levels first. So it's collaborative.
Yeah, definitely. Just to normalize some things that are common. So would you say conflict resolution and building that friendship and building the more romantic side, are those some of the core themes that you see people come in seeking support for? Or are there any other common threads that you notice between a lot of the couples that come to get support?
Yeah, I think conflict management is definitely number one. And, you know, I joke with my couples that I have never seen yet a couple who comes in and that level is just wonderful and positive, because all of us can improve our communication. The truth is, none of us are taught this from the moment we're born, right? We learn what we see and observe, and there are no such things as perfect families, and people have conflict and everything is learned. Like you weren't born not handling conflict good, for example, right? It's all a learned experience and it can be unlearned and you can learn something new. So a lot of times a big chunk of work is there, because then if we're fighting better, and arguments can be an opportunity to love each other better, to see how your partner responds and what they need to feel loved and what you need. So it can be really beautiful process of getting closer, which for many couples are like, what do you mean? I'm avoiding conflict. It's not a good thing. But fights are not good. But the truth is, it can be a good thing. And a lot of times we'll start there. And then they'll notice that everything else is improving as well. If you're fighting better, then you're feeling closer and so on. Because oftentimes, you know, when there are a lot of unfortunate fights that don't go well, a sense of being let down or betrayals. And when I say betrayals, I don't just mean infidelity, but any kind of moments where you felt let down, and unkept promises can be betrayals or little lies, things like that. When those accumulate, it's really hard to feel close to your partner. So then there is distance and we're no longer the good friends that we were once when we met, for example. And of course, if we're not friends and I don't even like you anymore, we're not going to be good in that romance, passion, sex, that department as well. So they're also interconnected. And I think once clients understand that, oh, this is what I need, and these are the steps I can actually take to feel that closeness, if they're motivated, it's really beautiful to see that progress happen.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, I love that. And one of the things about the Gottman research that I loved so much when I first came across it was one of the first books I read of theirs was 8 Dates, which I just thought was so helpful. And something in there that they said was happy couples are not like unhappy couples in the amount that they argue, but they are just more likely to repair and get back to actually enjoying the relationship. And so I think that piece on conflict resolution is so important. But you said something in an article that you wrote for the Gottman Institute where you said resolution of conflict is misguided and it's actually more about repairing. So because of their statistic of perpetual challenges in a relationship make up 69%, instead of trying to resolve things, it's more about repairing. So how do you help couples realize that maybe they don't have to actually solve all of the problems? How do they come to an agreement or rekindle after conflict when maybe they feel they're just stuck in problem solving mode?
Yeah. I think it's all about acceptance. It boils down to that. And this is more from like a mindfulness perspective, I guess. But the idea is that, you know, you said it, the 69% of conflict and problems that we have in relationships is not solvable. When I say this, couples get so discouraged at first. They're like, what? Why are we here? It's a high number. But it's not, it's because those fights and the problems are due to our differences that we have as people, our upbringing, how we process things, our experiences. We're just different people. And it's not so much even a matter of right and wrong, but who you are as a person. So, you know, with therapy, you can become the best version of yourself. You can improve, but you're still going to be you. You cannot force someone to change and become somebody else. So that concept of acceptance, of seeing your partner for who they are and accepting the parts of them maybe that you're not liking so much and learning to live with them. Not that that doesn't mean that you give up or you don't advocate for what's important for you or you can't have compromises, even if they're temporary compromises, you can kind of adjust, but you become more flexible because there is this acceptance instead of, no, I really need to change you and you need to really think like me and be like me. And so a lot of times when couples are stuck, it's because they're doing just that. They're trying to change each other at the core of who they are. And they're really also stuck at seeing the conflict from only their perspective. I have my experience, you have yours. This is my truth, you have your truth. And usually in conflict discussions, there are two subjective realities happening at the same time. If I were to put a couple and say, hey, here's art pieces and pencils and paint or whatnot, draw this little cup, it wouldn't be identical. Their drawings would be still different, even though it's the same cup and the same room and the same lighting. It's because we see things differently. So I think to move past it, couples learn that I can accept a different perspective, that my partner may see the situation differently. And it's not so much a matter of what happened and who's right and who's wrong, but what was your experience like? I'm going to get curious about it. And you can get curious about my experience. And we can repair that bond and that connection through understanding instead of coming to some kind of a conclusion of this is the right way. And sometimes that happens as well, where in their discussion, one might say, oh, I never thought of it that way. Yes, I can see how I was very rude to you. I didn't mean to, but I'm sorry. I can see how that came off so rude. And there is that accountability of I was wrong, right? But it's done with love and it's done with understanding and growth. So Mashi, if I answered your question or I went somewhere else completely with it, because I tend to do that.
It was great. Yeah. It kind of reminded me of this notion that a lot of times what we're probably disagreeing about is not even necessarily the full picture. There's a symptom, but then the root might be, I just want to feel understood and I want to feel validated, or I want there to be a safe space to be able to express something. But really it's like, oh, the dishes are in the sink, or, oh, you did this thing, you did that thing. And so, like you said, if you can get curious about what's underneath that, it's such a powerful opportunity to learn more about your partner. And do you recommend that happening right away? Or like if people are struggling to repair, should they take space? Should they regroup and then come back to the situation? How do you usually recommend to inch back towards repair if you're still feeling overwhelmed or overstimulated from a disagreement?
Yeah, I think taking a break is very much advised to do. If you notice that you're still upset, oftentimes we can be what's called flooded. This is where your heartbeat is over 100 beats per minute. You know, you feel just completely overwhelmed. The emotional mind takes over the prefrontal cortex that's in charge of logic, parts of our brain that take care of humor, all of that problem solving are offline. So it's really hard in that moment to productively solve a problem or to even hear your partner what they're saying. So it's pointless. I tell my clients, if you try to continue the conversation that time or solve something, it's just pointless. Your partner is not hearing you. You're not in a position to hear them. So taking a little break is important. But there's a technique to this, right? You don't just leave the room because that can do more harm. You want to, when things are going well, you want to establish this rule. We get upset, let's take a break, and maybe we will have a name for it. Okay, we're flooded. Let's take a break and resume in 30 minutes. Now, you want to take at least 20 minutes, and it can be longer. It can be a day, right? But you always want to say when you're going to come back, so your partner isn't left feeling anxious. Are we going to resolve this? Or your partner isn't left making up stories in their mind as to why you left. They don't care about what I have to say. They didn't even hear me. And they don't know that you're maybe overwhelmed. They just need time to regroup. So verbalizing that is very important. And then, so the way it goes is you say, okay, we're flooded. How about we pause and resume in 20, 30 minutes? And then let's say you go in, you take your 20, 30 minute break. And it's important that during this break, you do something that's not further upsetting you. So you don't want to spend this 30 minutes thinking about how your partner is just horrible and everything they've done that's wrong, and think about everything else from the past. Like, that's not going to help. You want to do something that's going to be soothing to your nervous system. That could be going on a walk. Maybe you're journaling. Maybe you have a session with your therapist. Maybe you have going to the bath or shower and just notice how the water feels on your skin. Meditation, exercise, anything that's kind of get you in a better place, right? And that's when you want to have that conversation. But let's say you come back, it's been 30 minutes and you're still upset. It's okay to say, hey, I'm still upset. I need longer. Can we resume at 5 p.m. or something like that? You always want to come back. You always want to say when you're going to come back to have that conversation.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. And I know for myself, and something I hear a lot is, I know that at my conscious level, that taking a break or pausing or something, like, that's the thing that would help. But in the moment, if my conscious brain is offline and I'm just flooded or overwhelmed and maybe not necessarily thinking clearly, and so maybe I say something I don't mean, or I kind of lash out, or I have a coping mechanism that isn't the way that I have practiced before. So what advice do you give to people who maybe they've heard certain things, but it's a lot harder in practice?
Yeah, I mean, most things are. So I think it's so important to have self-compassion, that we're not looking for perfection. We're looking for progress. When you mess up, catch yourself, go back, try it again. Own up to your mistake. I think that is so powerful in relationships, to show that vulnerable human side of, I messed up, I'm sorry. It allows your partner to do the same instead of getting defensive or really wanting to be right every single time. And I think it's important that if you say something wrong or in the moment, it's hard for you to do what the right thing is, it's a really good opportunity to explore that on your own. What is it difficult about this? Why is it tough for me to do that? Is there anything from the past that's getting in the way? Because as far as couples work is concerned, right, it's really about practicing the skills. And when you mess up, go back and try again and owning up to it. Because it, you know, if you're, I don't know, let's say you're 30 years old, you've been doing this for most 30 years. You've been programmed to observe fights this way, or you've been participating in fights this way. It's not going to take a session or two or a week or two to all of a sudden switch everything. It's practice. And sometimes all of us can react in our old unhealthy ways, and that's fine. So I think it's important to be compassionate, but just make effort. It also shouldn't be used as an excuse. Well, it's hard, so I messed up again, whatever. But you want to make effort and be intentional with what you do, but also have some self-compassion that it's going to take some time and you might forget sometimes. And if you do, that's a great opportunity to go, okay, so this wasn't handled well. I'm not so proud of how I managed this. What can I do to repair with my partner? But also, what can I do individually to improve? And I always tell clients generally that if you think someone was, you know, you're fight or something is bothering you about someone else, and you're thinking that you are 90% correct and they're wrong, can you still find that 10%? Where you have something to grow and you can do better? And not in a way you need to always look at how you're messing up, or because there are situations where people are victimized and things like that. So I'm not talking about that. But just in arguments, can you look at your part? And even if it's 1% and you look at that and you work on it, that's where growth is going to happen. Because if you think you never do anything wrong and it's all your partner, that's going to be tough, because it's a dance. It's a dynamic that we create with our partners.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's really beautiful. And you said earlier in the episode something about this is stuff that takes practice. Yes, the Gottmans have researched so much of what works, but that's only because they've seen people consistently show up in that way. And so when you understand some of these skills, it's still going to take practice, because you have had years and years and years of certain patterns or certain programs. And so with anything, whether it's learning pottery or learning how to paint or learning how to ride a bike, those things take intentional practice. But there's this romance story, novel, happy ending where you're like, oh, it should just be easy and we don't have to. And we haven't really been taught that it can take that energy. So I'm glad that you brought that reminder in. What are some of the, you mentioned the sound relationship house, and I have looked into that before and kind of know some of the principles. There's things like understanding your partner's love maps, creating a sense of fondness and admiration for one another, turning toward each other, managing conflict, which we touched on already, and then building life dreams and sharing meaning together. So are there any elements of the sound relationship house that you feel are worth diving into a little bit more today? Like any favorite practices or information about any of those that you want to share?
You know, which one I think is important that sometimes misunderstood, but I find that in my work can make such a huge difference, especially in our lives today and the couples that I see who are just busy with handling and managing so much in their lives between work and kids and parents and families and everything else, right? In the house and turning towards every day in our relationships and our life, little tiny, tiny, tiny ways, we make what Gottman's call bids for connection. So think of bids for connection as attempts to connect with your partner. They can be verbal or they can be nonverbal. So for example, if you are, you had a long day at work, you come home and your partner is on the computer doing something and you go in and you're like, oh, you know what happened today at work? And you want to just share something, right? That's your way of connecting with your partner, whether you realize it or not. That's a, hey, I want to share this story or this thing that I witnessed today. Your partner has the opportunity in that moment to either turn towards, turn away, or turn against. So turning towards would be your partner looking up from their computer and saying, oh, hey, honey, what happened? Right? And just giving you eye contact. I'm interested in what you have to say. Turning away would be if they ignored, not on purpose even, but just let's say I'm just emailing something very important. My mind is just really trying to finish this sentence. And my partner says, you know what happened at work today? But crickets, I don't say anything. That would be turning away. Turning against would be if I attacked them. If I look up and go, can't you see I'm busy? Tell me later. Something rude like that. It can also be nonverbal. Let's say I am again on my computer and my partner is walking by me and they just rub my shoulder. Hey, do I acknowledge that? Because that little touch on my shoulder is a way of connecting. Like, hey, I see you. What's up? There's something there. Do I turn and smile at them? Do I turn and give them a kiss? Do I just hold their hand back or do I ignore? Or do I go, ugh, don't touch me? Mm-hmm. How do I respond to that? A big one that I think is huge in our society and we're probably all guilty of at one point in our lives is our phones. We're attached to our phones. They're a body part at this point, right? A lot of times you see when one partner is talking, the other one is on their phone and that's turning away. I'm talking to you, but you're not really showing interest that you're listening to me. So most of the time couples do this when they turn away, not on purpose. They're not trying to purposely sit there and go, how am I going to harm my partner here? And how am I going to show them that I don't really care about them? No, it's because we have so much going on. Mm-hmm. My partner may come in and ask me a question and I'm really trying to figure out childcare in that moment and doing the calculations in my head and everything. So the goal is to just become aware of this and to try to turn towards more than not in everyday life situation. Yeah. And what I find is that what kills relationships when couples break up, divorce, separate, is not usually these big events that happen. I mean, that can happen too, but mostly it's because they grow apart. There is distance that just grows and grows and grows. And I find that this little level, this turning towards, can be so helpful because when you turn towards your partner when they're trying to talk to you or they give you any kind of bid for like, hey, look at me, I'm here, you're sending the message that you matter to me. I'm interested in you and in what you have to say. I care about your day. I care about how you're doing. And at the end of the day, that's all we want as human beings. We want connections with others, like really deep, intimate, genuine connections. And the opposite is true. I keep turning towards you to connect and I keep feeling rejected, ignored. What's going to happen? I'm probably going to either get frustrated, pick fights, get upset, or maybe I will give up and I will pull back. And maybe then someone will come along who who's giving me attentions, and then I will turn towards that person more. Right. And that could be like the start of the slippery slope towards affairs. Right. So I find that that level is so, it's so much bigger than, are you giving attention to your partner? I think that builds trust as well. I've noticed that if I feel my partner cares about me, then I trust them more. So I would say focusing on that level can make such a big difference in couples' lives. And it's just really all about becoming aware of it and making a conscious decision to turn towards your partner more. Again, doesn't mean you're not going to mess up, because we all have moments. We can't be on 100% every single day, every moment. There are going to be missed moments, missed opportunities. You're going to mess up. Can you own up to it and try to turn towards more? That's it. And it's also okay. That doesn't mean, by the way, that if my partner comes and says, hey, you know what happened at work today? I have to drop everything and give them the attention, because maybe I'm doing something important. Maybe I'm with the kids. Maybe I am emailing a work time-sensitive information or something. It's okay to say, hey, honey, give me 1 second. I'll listen to you. I need a second. But just acknowledging them somehow is still a great response.
Yeah, I like that last point about it doesn't have to be perfect. I was just going to ask, because I feel a lot of people listening resonate with how I feel about things. And one thing that used to be more of a challenge, but I've definitely practiced it, is this question of what is a fair or healthy expectation of my partner to always turn toward me? Because there are times where I will just raise my hand and say, like, I see my fiance is working on something, but I just still waltz in and I'm like, oh, this thing happened or whatever. And it's not necessarily fair that if I'm interrupting something that he always has to pause and acknowledge what's going on. So what is the fair or healthy expectation of a partner turning toward you? Because we can say they don't have to be perfect, but when does it become, oh, hey, I think there's a need of attention or a need for validation that's not getting met consistently enough, versus when the bar is just so high and you're expecting them to always be at your every whim?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to note that no one can always meet our needs, and no one person will ever meet all our needs. And I think that's also, not to go away from this topic, a lot of people have that expectation where if they had some attachment wounds, attachment trauma, where the caregiver, parents in this case, usually weren't able to meet their needs, there is this void of one person meeting all their needs, which is unrealistic, because no one can do that. That's how we have different people. And even amongst our friends, if you think about our friends, we have different friends and they're all different personalities. And we know that this person might be really good at like fun events, but when I need this intimate deep conversation to grab coffee and go deeper, they're not really as comfortable with that maybe, but I have this friend for that, right? Or just different things. And similarly for our partner, it's just one person. So they can't always be on point. I think what we're looking for with turning it towards, but also all the other levels, conflict and things like that, is our partner willing to do the work with us? Is our partner willing to listen and make effort to turn towards most of the time? And maybe right now it's at zero, that's not happening again, but your partner starts, listens to this, reads some books, does therapy, and then goes, I'm going to try. And it goes from 0 to 5 and 10 and whatnot. But that's already progress. It's not at 100, but it's the effort that I think is more important in relationships. The willingness to try than the result. Because sometimes also couples come in and there's been so much that's happened. And maybe even individually before they got together, it's been so much trauma. It's a lot of stuff and it's going to take time. But as long as there is that willingness, you can make progress. You can feel more connected. So I would say it's just that willingness to connect, to repair. It's so important.
Yeah, well said. And thanks for the reminder too about no one person meeting all of our needs and the balance of other people in our lives as well. Speaking of connection, all of that, there's balance between emotional connection and friendship that is really valuable in a relationship, but also that more exciting piece, a little bit more of the romance, or a little bit more of what people say as the spark, which I don't love that word, but more of, okay, feeling excited and feeling more playful and passionate in the relationship, which I know is not a permanent state, but How do you work with couples if they're feeling like, let's say, I'll just give a personal example. Like my fiance and I were so great at the friendship and the emotional connection, and we do prioritize the passion, but it is very intentional. It's not always as natural for us to be in that state. So it has to be a priority. How do you work with couples that are, their passion is dwindling, or it's not balanced like they want it to be? Where do you start?
Yeah. So the bottom three levels of the sound relationship house are what represents the friendship, but also the romance really is those three levels. And if you think about early dating, when you meet someone and you're just in love and everything is going great, those three bottom levels are met naturally. You know, it just comes so easy to for all of us. So the love maps are your knowledge of your partner's inner world. So it's like friendship level. If you think about your best friends, you probably know what they like, what they don't like, you know, what shows they're into, what music they're into, what kind of food they like, their favorite places. But you also probably know their sad days in their life they've had, and maybe you've been through them with them, right? You know about their dreams, their hopes, but you also know about their fears. And so that's the level for couples as well. And when we're dating someone newly, we try to get to know them. So it is that all the conversations, like, what do you like? What was your life like before me? We get to know them. And so that level is doing great early on. Again, most relationships. Then, you know, of course, fondness and admiration too. You show them how much you like them, right? And that's the level of, do I feel liked, adored, respected in this relationship by my partner? So if you're early dating, usually they tell you they like you, right? There's compliments, or even non-verbally, there's hugs, there's affection that you go, okay, yeah, they're into me, they like me, right? So that's organically met. And then the turning towards, which I mentioned earlier, everything your partner says when you're on a date early on, you're interested in. If you go on the first, second date and your date is talking and you're on your phone, there probably wouldn't be a second, third date. So I think we're very intentional about, I want to hear you. There's eye contact, there's smiling, there's holding hands, tell me more. All that comes very naturally because A, we're on our best behavior early on. Two, we are really like mesmerized by this person. We're into them. We want them to like us. So it just happens so naturally. And that's why the passion of the relationship is so good early on. And then what happens is we get comfortable with each other and we stop doing what was important once, those things that really made this relationship and this romance part of a relationship good. So we start asking questions about each other, you know, assuming, well, I know this person, but the truth is we all change. I'm not the same person I was a year ago. I'm not the same person I was 5 years ago. So to keep up that love maps, to continuously learn about your partner is important, and to continuously show them that they are liked, that they are respected, that they are adored by you. And in whichever ways has been shown in your relationship before, maybe that's through compliments, maybe that's physically hugging, touching, like very physical dates, and even having those deep conversations about how you are appreciative of them. And of course, what I said, the turning towards, right? If they're talking to you, if they're trying to connect with you, put your phone down, try to make eye contact with them. If you need to be on your phone, which again, we're not looking for perfection, but just let them know in a sweet way, hey, babe, I want to hear what you have to say. Give me 5 minutes. I need to finish this email, whatever it is. That will translate to, I feel close with my partner. I feel emotionally safe with my partner. This is a fun relationship, which really helps with that romance, passion, part of the relationship. And then there, after that, if you're still struggling, there are more things. Gottmans have this really fun card decks. I think it's on their website too, but there's an app as well. And they are what they call salsa cards, which really ask questions, ideas in regards to sexual intimacy. So you can kind of see, what are we into? Maybe we can try something else and explore and experiment. So you can do that too. But it's important to work on the bottom levels, because if I don't feel safe with you, if I feel like you don't even like me, you don't even care about listening what I have to say, and you're on your phone, I don't know if I'm going to be into exploring some fun ways we can expand our sexual intimacy. Like, it's not going to come naturally or organically. So I would say starting from the bottom three levels would be really good. And after that, get this card deck or get the app. You can check that out. Outside of Gottman's, there's also Esther Perel talks a lot about that. And she has really amazing books about romance, passion, intimacy, all of that.
Yeah, well said. And one thing to add too, just from my own experience, is sometimes those bottom three levels, the love maps, the fondness and admiration, the turning toward, you said something really powerful earlier about how like our own past attachment wounds can sometimes be the thing that is interfering with the dynamics. We all bring in our own stuff. And so if anyone's having a hard time doing those things, just a reminder that that doesn't always mean that the relationship has problems or the person you're with has problems. It can be if I'm not feeling fondness and admiration for my partner because I'm in my own head worrying that I might get divorced like my parents, that's a lot that's blocking you from being open and connected. So just remembering too that in addition to all the relationship work we're talking about, like Anna said earlier, there's sometimes some inner stuff that needs to happen separately outside of the relationship so that you can be more open-hearted and show up in the way that you're hoping to nurture the relationship with.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we all have our own stuff. There isn't one person who doesn't have anything they could work on and improve. So I think, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I do think every person could benefit from therapy and from reading self-help books and trying to improve themselves.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, my final two questions, one I ask all my guests, because this is the You Love and You Learn podcast. What is one thing that you have learned about love that you would want to leave listeners with?
Wow, I love that question. You know, I would say that love, and I'm talking about the love. Well, can I say two things about that?
Because
I like
course.
What I want to go with, and I like both. So I like to think of love generally, not because when we say love, we think about our romantic partners and that kind of love. But love can be everything else, and love can be part of who you are as a person, as a human being, in terms of if you embrace whatever love means to you. So that could be kindness, that could be connection with others, that could be being alive, right? Can you take that with you every day? So it's really becomes a part of your essence. And I think people who are so magnetic and they are so easy to talk to and genuine, it's almost like they have that already. They just are just bright, walking little love people. And I think if you can just think of love, not just to mean the romantic word of it that we learned in movies and songs and things like that, but more of can I just take what that means and reflect that to the world? I think that's such a peaceful way of being. That's for the individual, but you know, that also helps for you to relate better in relationships. And then as far as for relationships, you know, I think that it's important to know that love, romantic relationships, is conditional. Because I think many people, again, like what you're saying, the movies, the romance, like the songs that we saw, it makes you believe that it's unconditional. That means I love them no matter what. But the truth is, in adult romantic relationships, love is conditional. You want to choose someone who's good to you and good for you so that you don't stay in bad, abusive relationships. It doesn't mean that it has to be a perfect relationship. No one is perfect, but there needs to be a balance of give and take by both partners and efforts by both partners to make a relationship work. And unfortunately, we also see as therapists the other side of it, where people are in relationships that's really one-sided, that's really unhealthy, that's toxic, that's abusive, and people stay because they love them unconditionally, right? And I think it's important to know that for adult relationships, it is conditional. You can love your children unconditionally, you know, love your dog and your cat unconditionally. That's fine. But I think for a healthy relationship to exist, both partners' needs need to be met. Both partners need to be heard. Both partners' emotional well-being matters. So if you notice that you are in a relationship that's just really not the case, it's good to reach out to a therapist so that you can heal through it and also learn to love yourself in the process.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, thank you so much for all of the wisdom you've shared so far today. If people want to stay connected with you, where do you recommend that they connect with you online, or what's the best way to stay in touch?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. This was a lovely conversation. Yeah, if people want to find me, where they can find about me and our practice, where there's other therapists who trained like me, at my website, which is mytherapycorner.com. Like I said, we also post a lot of good information and resources on our Instagram page at mytherapycorner.com, also Facebook page with the same name. And if they need to contact us, we do provide therapy to clients located in California, Florida, and New York. They can just email us through either one of those places. There is a contact me form they can fill out, and then we can call them back or email them back.
Thank you so much. It was great to chat with you. And thanks everybody for listening. We will see you in the next episode.
Thank you so much for listening to the You Love and You Learn podcast. If you've been enjoying the podcast, it would mean the absolute world to me if you could rate and review the podcast, because the more ratings and reviews there are, the more people that can hear this message. And it's really important to me to get this message out to the world and to create a space where people can learn about love and relationships in a way that is not judgmental, in a way that helps them expand their perspective from the cultural narratives that we've heard and seen in the movies and in Hollywood and the media. And the more ratings and reviews that are there, the more people that can hear this message. So thank you again so much. It really means the world to me that you are listening, and see you in the next episode.